moral ecology of everyday life. And today, we've convened a group of people who would rather drive cars than walk in the mountains to talk about driven.
We just got double flipped.
Oh, okay, good.
We got back in time.
Driven, the moral ecology of cars.
We didn't have cars, we didn't have a lot of choice.
And actually, Holden is a good place to talk about cars because you get a sense here of what kinds of life are possible without cars. Think about the one of the few places in the country that are really pedestrian communities and what that means to our sense of community. Imagine, for example, if we all had cars here. We were all allowed to drive our cars up here if there are a car ferry here. For one thing, the village would have to be it'd have to be spread out more because we'd all need parking places. And we'd all have parking places, say at our chalet. Mike and I are up on the chalet circle up there, and Joel too. And all of us would have parking spaces for our cars up there at the chalet circle, which would be now a larger circle, and it would be spread out some from the center of town. And when it was dinner time, we'd all get in our cars, and we'd all drive down to the hotel to have dinner. And we'd need a parking lot at the hotel, too.
There'd be a traffic jam.
That's right, there'd be a traffic jam as all of us from the however many chalets are up there came down the hill. So we'd have congestion, but we'd need another parking place down here as well.
Oh, just like home.
Yeah. And we need gas stations, and we'd need repair places and all kinds of things like that. So it would really change the nature of community. Another thing that I think would happen is that when the three of us came down, we would get out of our cars and walk immediately into the hotel, because we would, for one thing, have paved over the plaza to make the parking lot. There would be no space where people would come face to face. And in pedestrian communities, essentially, that's what happens. You structure the spaces so that people come face to face, and people are much more likely to interact if they're simply like we are now than when they're inside boxes made of metal and plastic and glass.
And instead of greeting each other, you'd be muttering about that so-and-so up ahead that's in the way.
That's right. We'd be cursing, actually. God, can't get moving. So the nature of the interactions would also be changed if we had cars here. And I'm conscious of it here, but I was also conscious of it earlier this year when my family and I went with my wife. We had a convention to Orlando, and we were at Disney World and stayed at one of the outlying hotels on the Disney property, where they just move everybody around by essentially rapid transit, or in the case of the monorails, light rail transit. And I mean, knowing Minneapolis, people are really irritated about the idea of light rail transit. They think this is an unworkable kind of thing, but it seems to work very well at Disney World. And it's a very pleasant kind of situation to be able to get up in the morning and walk around the area where your hotel is and know that you're not going to be run over by a car. There's not going to be a lot of traffic noise. There's not going to be a lot of smog. There's going to be a lot of cartoon characters who look ridiculous. But there are some disadvantages to it. But the idea of a pedestrian community, I think, is real, real nice. Well, I've prepared some remarks here, but some of you have probably been driving cars a lot longer than I have, and so as I've said in earlier days, I don't really have a train of thought when I'm doing these kinds of things. I have some things written down. When I get to the end here, things get kind of mushy because I didn't really figure out how to conclude this one. I had a kind of ringing conclusion on day one and then day two. Here on day three, I've not yet gotten to the conclusion, and so maybe you people can help me out with that. So let me start with Jesus. Jesus was a citizen of an underdeveloped country, and so he didn't have a car. But I am a citizen of an overdeveloped country, and so I have two of them, a Ford Taurus and a Honda Civic. And in fact, I've had to buy both of them within 2 weeks this spring because our other two cars have just both gone over 100,000 miles and hit the high. And so I went through what I think is a form of either purgatory or hell. This is buying a new car in this country. But in having these two cars, which we have in our family, I'm a typical American. Americans have twice as many cars per capita as the people of Western Europe, and 258 times as many cars as the people of India. 41% of the world's cars are owned by Americans, and we buy 9 million cars a year, new cars. I made my contribution to that this year. Cars count for 10% of the gross national product. So when we're talking about changing the way that we work with cars, we are talking about really substantial changes in American life. 15 million Americans, 22% of the American workforce, work making and servicing cars in one way or another. And we spend 15% of our income and a tremendous deal of time on automotive transport. We are what James Flink calls, in a wonderful and very, very long book, calls a car culture. The car and our culture are really intertwined. They're essential to each other. 100 years ago, as I said, I think yesterday, believe it or not, there were no cars in the United States. 1893 was the first gasoline-powered car in the United States. By 1895, there were car races. And in 1895, somewhere in that period, there was a time when there were four cars in the United States, and two of them were involved in a collision. I just love the idea. Half the cars in the United States involved in one. But anyway, 100 years ago, as far as historians can tell, people lived fully human lives without automobiles. They walked or they used the power of animals to transport themselves. For long distances, they rode railroads. In cities, they rode trolleys. Now in America, a life without cars is virtually unthinkable, except in remote places like this. Cars have become a part of what Robert Bella calls the habits of our heart. The car is an essential element of contemporary American culture. The word automobile combines two classic American values, auto, the self, or I, or American individualism, and mobility, the movement of these individuals around. The car is a machine for the mobility of the self, a technology that embodies American values of individualism, freedom, mobility, comfort, and convenience, which is why it's such an essential part of our lives.
And it strikes me you might add privacy as well.
Yeah, also.
Element of privacy.
Also privacy, and which is, I think, is some of the reason that people don't like riding public transport, is that you might end up sitting next to someone that you don't know, and in a car that doesn't happen very often, that you sit with somebody that you don't know. And apropos of that remark, cars, claims Richard North in this book that I mentioned the other day called The Real Cost, represent private versus public morality. We construct an industry to allow us private choice, and the private choices that we make are often opposed to a kind of public morality. Cars are a technology which in America has been synonymous with progress. With their annual model changes, which began in the 1920s, cars have been more than any other technology incorporated American dreams of planned obsolescence and inevitable progress. You never see a car maker come out with, say, a new 1994 car and say, well, it's about the same as the 93, or it's really not quite as good as the 92. They're always, quote, new and improved, so we get this sense of progress. And in many cases, you know, this is absolutely true, they are new and improved. There are improvements. The new 1993 Ford is a small part of what one critic calls the tradition of the new. If you think about that phrase very carefully, it's a very paradoxical kind of phrase. We have a tradition of the new. We are conservative about the things that are new in our lives, and we like to have new things in our lives. But a technology, as Langdon Winter points out in a beautiful book called The Whale and the Reactor, is a complex reality, part of what Robert Bella would call the problem of invisible complexity. The things we call technologies, Winter says, are ways of building order in the world. The issues that divide or unite people in society are settled not only in the institutions and practices of politics proper, but also, and less obviously, in tangible arrangements of steel and concrete, wires and semiconductors, nuts and bolts. Cars make many things possible and many other things improbable. They are as political as the Democrats and the Republicans, and they are more effective than either of those parties because we don't suspect them of anything. And we're suspicious about the Democrats and the Republicans. But cars embody a kind of politics and a set of political decisions that we've made over the last century, and we hardly ever see them because they are part of what Bella calls the invisible complexity. A car is a wheeled vehicle powered usually by an internal combustion engine. And here is a paragraph that I wrote when I do a lot of interdisciplinary work at St. Olaf, and I keep trying to show how there are very few things in life that are disciplinary. where one discipline can give you an adequate answer to anything. And so I was trying to think of what it means to drive a car in disciplinary terms. Driving a car is an event which requires a biological being to sit in a technological artifact manufactured and distributed in a market economy and produce a chemical reaction to make mechanical power in social spaces that are constructed and regulated by political entities. That's the first sentence. Cars have affected cultural geography, domestic architecture, foreign policy, and social psychology in this country. So they really are sort of a product of all the different disciplines. You would need a whole college to understand cars. As Andrew Wernick says, cars transform the whole ecology of life, both at the individual level, affecting private and occupational mobility, indeed our whole sense of time and space, and socially, creating massive dependent industries, road systems, and transformed cities. Okay, this wheeled vehicle with an internal combustion engine requires oil, a non-renewable energy resource which is fast being depleted. Oil was discovered in the United States in 1859 at Titusville, Pennsylvania. Since 1976, however, Americans have used more petroleum for transportation than we have produced, and cars account for a greater share of oil demand than they did at the time of the first oil crisis. The production and distribution of gasoline, which comes from this oil, actually at first when oil was invented, it wasn't used for internal combustion engines at all, it was used for lighting. And so they used it for kerosene, and gasoline, which is a byproduct of making kerosene, was just dumped in rivers for years and years and years, for about 40 years, because it wasn't useful for anything until cars were invented, and then it was able to Europe to find oil for that. But the production and distribution of gasoline involves energy and environmental costs of its own. Oil wells and oil rigs take energy to construct and maintain, and they routinely leak oil into the environment. They are part of what Charles Perrow calls normal accidents. We construct technologies in such a way that we have normal accidents. You see this sort of language of normal accidents also, say, in the nuclear power industry. They talk about similar sorts of things. The transportation of oil by pipeline and tanker also involves energy expenditures and accidents. The United States is, in fact, the number one nation in the world for major oil spills affecting our shores. The Exxon Valdez accident was just one of many normal accidents that we plan by our use of gasoline-powered cars. Americans use disproportionately high amounts of this fossil fuel oil because Americans drive so much. An average American will travel about 10,000 miles a year by car, while Europeans travel 4,200 miles, and third world people travel almost none. Even though America's cars are 35% of world cars in use, they drive 1,250,000,000,000 miles annually, as much as all other world cars together. People in America's car cities use twice as much gas per capita as people in Australia's cities, four times as much as European urbanites, and 10 times as much as Asian city drivers. Even rising prices of oil do not reflect its real cost to society. They don't take account of the finite character of oil reserves or of the environmental burdens of a gas-powered country. Nor is oil the only resource depleted in cars. We also have in cars steel, glass, rubber, all of which also consume energy. And a little bit later, I'll tell you about it. There's an article in the current New Yorker, which Joel pointed out to me today, on tires and what to do with automobile tires. And I'll read you an excerpt or two from that later on. Cars also require, in addition to the oil and all of the sort of complications that go along with the oil that's needed for cars, they require a kind of infrastructure. They require service stations, oases of gasoline and of repairs that keep Americans on the road with or without Charles Perrault. Cars require parking places. Parking a car at home, the office, and the shopping mall requires an average 44,000 square feet of asphalt. And if you think about it, you know, you have your car, you have your space for it in the garage, you have the space of the driveway coming up to the garage that's paved, and then everywhere that you want to go with the car has to have a parking spot available for your car. So we pave an extraordinary amount of this country. At home, we park cars in the garage, a structure which in my neighborhood is larger and more commodious than most third world houses. The garage is an interesting cultural invention. because it replaced a barn for horses or a livery stable down the street. It originally was located at some distance from a middle-class home. Usually the home was fairly near the front of the property and the stable was very near the back because people were trying to keep the smells at some distance. Then the garage moved somewhat closer, but still as a freestanding structure. My parents' home has a freestanding garage. Now it has moved into the house. In many cases, dominates the architectural facade of the house. I live in a sort of new suburban development. And the houses now out there have three-car garages. And by the time you put three cars on the front of a house, there isn't much house left. I mean, it's sort of like three garages across the front with a little gable over it, about what you get on these houses. The reason for this movement of the garage may simply be convenience. And I do experience the convenience of having an attached garage, particularly in Minnesota. But the authors of a book called Driving Passion think that it may also symbolize Americans' acceptance of cars into the family. And it's true that now two-thirds of all new houses in the United States have two-car garages. So you can see by our architecture the expectation of our use of cars.
Just as you're saying that, I'm reminded, however, of what happened in a sod house, which is that the barn and the house were part of the same structure in order to use the animals, partly to use the animals' heat to heat the house.
Yeah.
How, to put that against those things that you're saying, add some additional ironies.
Yes, I mean, and in a way, what I think is going to happen in the United States in the next 100 years or so is that people are going to start living closer together just in order to conserve heat. The three-car garage on the houses in my neighborhood and the freestanding single-family dwelling are extremely wasteful of heat, especially in Minnesota where there's all that exposed surface to let out air into the cold in the winter. And the more you cluster housing, the more you save heat. Which is one of the ways in which Americans use energy most.
So, Carson, can I mention one other thing about the paving a moment ago? My impression is when you build up, these are a couple climatic effects. When you build cities and you do pave a lot, one is higher heat. The urban areas are warmer generally than if it's asphaltedness.
Right.
And the other is flooding. You have much more flooding as a result of the paving.
Right. In fact,
a lot more runoff.
It's been a great gift to be here at Holden and to have my topics listed in various places because people keep giving me magazines. Lori's husband, Gary, gave me a magazine called In Context, which I'll also read from in a minute. This issue is on designing a sustainable future, buildings, neighborhoods, and cities. And one of the things that some new city planners are taking into account is exactly that. That you're getting a resource, in this case, water, coming in. And the main thing that we do with that water in cities is to see how fast we can get it in gutters and get it out of the way. But it's a usable resource, and that you could have all kinds of greenery in cities that would be watered by the water that comes into the space of the city. So there's a tremendous amount of waste of other resources also in the way that we've structured paving, for example, to go with cars. Okay, cars also function in American culture as symbols, as they have at least since the 1920s. In that decade, researchers in Muncie, Indiana, discovered that many families owned cars but lacked indoor plumbing. And being sociologists, this made them curious. This is the reason we were doing the Middletown study. And they asked one person why. Well, she said, you can't go to town in a bathtub. And she was right, you can't go to town in a bathtub, but it's a sort of status symbol of having the car. Culturally, cars have been symbols of progress and modernity, and each year's annual model makes earlier models obsolescent as a progressive symbol. And you can still see this kind of symbolism in car ads. Car ads are really rich in the imagery and the kinds of ways that Americans think about technologies, and particularly about this technology, and also in the ways that they think about themselves, the ways in which the ads invite us, especially men, to think that we're going to be more virile when we get into cars, that we're going to have control of power and things like that. There's one ad now, a Dodge ad, in which the car itself flirts with a woman, which is a very strange thing to watch. And then when it turns out that the woman has a boyfriend already, the car is disappointed. but there's this kind of romance going on between the car and people all the time in American culture, and it's very, very peculiar. Kind of imagine what alien beings or anthropologists would feel like if they came down here and looked at us. I think that they would think that cars are a part of our religion, that they're something that we worship in one way or another. I noticed this spring the auto show was on in Minneapolis, and so I was paying attention to the pictures from the auto show. But you know, in the auto show, when they mount those cars up on those platforms and then they rotate the platforms like that, I mean, that suggests a really strong icon. We hardly even do that with religious things anymore. We've tried to democratize churches so much that we don't have that same sort of placement of the altar and things like that. And so there's just tremendous amount of care that we give to cars. Again, sort of living in the suburbs, you see on Saturdays, people out there, sort of just gentle care, caress of the car as they clean it and wax it and everything like that. Anyway, parked at home like furniture, like the domicile itself, cars project a sense of the owner's relative social standing. Out on the road, they carry that same sense of class and cultural identification into the wider cultural domain. Cars, in this respect, are similar to clothes, constituting indeed a kind of third skin for ambient industrial man. Like clothes, too, as markers of identity within an anonymously circulating public, they readily become subject to the fashion dynamics of competitive display, which manufacturers have naturally encouraged to accelerate obsolescence and sales. I saw a car ad in a magazine, I think on the airplane coming out here, for it was one of the luxury cars, and the ad was "Everything That's Possible." That was the title of the ad. "Everything That's Possible." You sort of think about that, okay? That's very nice. I mean, you get a lot of stuff on that car, but it doesn't say everything that's sensible, or it says everything that's possible. If you can do it, you do it. And it's a sort of can-do mentality to technologies that we adopt very often, and which we see a lot of in cars. Cars now come sort of with standard equipment with an incredible array of things. The Taurus that we brought this spring was a last year's model, which we got real cheap because they were, yes. because we got
renegade.
I just hate paying a lot of money for anything. I spend a lot of my life at garage sales and try to clothe myself there. But we bought a last year's model, but it happened to be sort of a top of the line not last year's model, and it had all these electric windows and things like that. And what I noticed about that, and when we bought the Honda too, is the cars are now designed so you have to buy an air conditioner. And 92% of American cars are sold with air conditioners. It used to be that the vents for cars went from the outside. Now the venting is all done through the engine, so that whenever you get air through the vents, it's hotter than the air outside. And if you open your windows, you put a drag on the car so that you use more gas with a drag on the car anyway, and so you might as well have the air conditioner on. But they're designed so that you can't be cooling them on a relatively hot day. It's just a crazy kind of thing where, you know, a very simple kind of design, like those little windows that used to be at the front of cars that would give you all that wonderful air across there. A very simple sort of kind of design would do what you want in a car. Although now I think part of the reason for air conditioning is that there's so much road noise and you can't hear your stereo system very well if you have all the road noise. And so the air conditioner is really, in fact, to go along with the sound system, which is another way of selling cars. Ford, for example, sells a lot of their cars by advertising the sound system, the JBL sound system in the Ford, rather than the car itself. So I'll get around to those things in the car, too. In the twin, I was talking when I got sort of deflected there, what we might say off the road in this context, about class and cultural context for cars. Cars do express class and social hierarchies. In the Twin Cities, that class and cultural status is reflected even in car ownership. 35% of Black and Indian households in the Twin Cities do not have cars. 18% of Hispanic and Asian households do without automobiles, but only 8% of white households are carless in the Twin Cities. And then there are variations of cars. I don't want to go into all of them because this would take us days to do, but the sports car, it seems to me, has different symbolic meanings from the family car. The sports car generally implies in the culture freedom, power, usually masculine, speed, single status, or married without children. The family car, on the other hand, serves the nuclear family and preserves it as a cultural icon. And a lot of cars are sold by association with both of these sets of images. The family and everybody in the family will be happy if they have this particular kind of car. The vans now are particularly sold because they have lots of seats and you can keep your children far enough apart from each other that they don't bug each other in the cars. I've always thought that you ought to sell family cars that were like taxi cabs that had the in between the seats, but you don't. The two rows of seats in a sort of regular sedan in a family car separate parents from children, parents almost always in the front seat, and represent the family hierarchy. And you can, if your kids bug you as much as mine do about the wanting to sit in the front seat, you can see that hierarchy is understood. The fact that father usually drives also represents different gender roles in the family, and also the relationship of different genders to technology in this society. Another thing as I was thinking about this is the way that we socialize people in our culture to think about cars. Boys, much more than girls, are taught to like cars, and I brought a couple of visual aids along. Deanne let me take out of her house a car that her son Thomas, who's now 1.5, has. And this comes out of some learning systems catalog or something like that. So by 1.5, we're just beginning to socialize boys to think that cars are important. And I brought along a Corvette Stingray Silver, which is really elegant, which my son Paul is going to get while he's here at Holden, and he'll just be delighted to get it. And I mentioned yesterday when I was talking about something else that the cars have really become our major rite of passage the driver's license has become our major rite of passage in American culture. That the age 16 is one of the most culturally significant ages in this country because that's the year at which you get your driver's license.
Not confirmation.
Yeah, right. I mean, confirmation is really, I think, to sort of culturally to our children, relatively insignificant compared to getting a driver's license. And I suspect that if you sort of gave them a straightforward choice and you told them that you wouldn't yell at them if they'd made the choice to confirm they would, most of them would choose the driver's license. And they'd probably like to get it at the age that they are confirmed.
Yeah.
It's usually earlier than 16. Okay, so we're pretty well set here with the kind of cultural and symbolic infrastructure for cars. So we kind of get in the car now and go for a drive. Once I'm in the car, in my car, say particularly in my Taurus, I take up almost 100 times the space I do on foot. And I am a different relation to the world and to my neighbors than I am when I am on foot. A person in a car experiences the landscape differently than a person on foot. A person on foot has time for details, but a person in a car is restricted only to general features of the landscape. You saw a lot more of the mountain by walking through it than we would if we paved this thing with four lanes and, you know, had cars that could go through it. Most cars, too, keep us from the weather. With wipers and heaters and air conditioners, they are enclosed environments that keep us from the surrounding environment. The car is rapidly becoming a home away from home, with its own stereo and telephone and fax, and who knows, kitchen someday. In my car, I also encounter my neighbors differently. Cars have the overall effect of spreading people out and keeping them apart. Rather than meeting people as we go about our business, to and from stores and school and work, generally we see each other in well-defined indoor spaces. So I'm as likely to see my neighbors at the supermarket as I am in the neighborhood, and it's likely to be that we have driven somewhere and ended up at the same spot and see them there rather than walking in the neighborhood, because there's really no practical reason to walk in the neighborhood because there are no commercial or retail structures in the neighborhood. The more traffic there is in an area, the less likely are residents to know their neighbors and to think of it as home territory. I think Bill McKibben in his book, The Age of Missing Information, cites the fact that 72% of Americans don't know their next door neighbor. When I pass my neighbors in my car as I pull out of the driveway, I am limited mainly to an expression of simple recognition. Usually goes something like this, you know. This becomes our interaction, a kind of a hand gesture. Rather than the kind of interaction that you might have, or you do have, if you happen to encounter them while you're walking in the neighborhood. Our neighborhood actually has some walking paths and things like that. So you do encounter people like that. And you almost always stop and exchange some information. But you almost never stop when you're in the car. Cars also reduce the practical interdependence of a neighborhood. This is something else I mentioned yesterday. The convenience of my car means that when I need a cup of sugar for a recipe, I'm as likely to drive to the store as to ask my neighbor for it. So this sense of practical interdependence in a neighborhood is undercut by car. So with that in mind, or more usually out of mind, I back my car out of the garage. If I am an average American driver, the car is virtually empty. 87% of American car trips have at most two passengers. In fact, although car in 1990, the number of trips per day rose by 3 million a day over a 20-year period. 3 million more car trips a day over a 20-year period rose by 74%, even though the population rose only by 19%. So we are driving an extraordinary more than we were in 1970. Only 2.5% of these trips are by bus. The rest are by automobiles. The average household makes 10 car trips a day, compared with 8 in 1970. But people in wealthier households average 14 car trips a day. Household travel diaries show that Twin Cities residents travel on average an hour a day in the environmental cocoon of a car, which means essentially that you spend 1/24th of your life in a car. The amazing increase in 20 years, most of which followed the oil crisis of 1973, when you might think logically that people would drive less, was caused by A, more cars, B, more people working, and C, more suburbanites. The Twin Cities are expanding all over the place, as are many cities. Still, due to more highways and more highway metering, the average commute time increased only a minute, from 20 to 21 minutes in 1990. The Minnesota Department of Transportation notes that in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area, 96% of the traffic volume comes from cars and only 4% from trucks and other kinds of commercial vehicles. 18% of the car trips in the metro area are from home to work. 53% are from home to some other activity like shopping. Only 29% of trips involve trips whose origin or destination is not home, trips from work to shopping or from shopping to shopping or something like that. Anyway, so I backed out of my garage. There's hardly anybody in my car. Quickly, I get out on the road and into congestion. My car gives me unlimited mobility and freedom, just as long as everybody else doesn't exercise their mobility and freedom at the same time. But more cars on the road have led to more congestion, which can almost bring traffic to a standstill. In Southern California, even with all the freeways and all the lanes on all the freeways, average car speeds are estimated at only 33 miles an hour, with predictions of a drop to 15 miles an hour by the year 2000. And there was a wonderful article from the Washington Post Weekly on sort of the science of traffic flow and the way that traffic flow works. They have all these factors figured out. So it's sort of a physics problem. It works like a liquid, so that when you brake, because there's a dog there, everybody begins to brake behind you, and then the person behind you brakes fairly quickly, but the person behind them has to brake a little bit faster, and so traffic slows to almost nothing immediately. And then when you begin to go faster, it works its way through the line of traffic a little bit slower than it does before, so that there are all of these places where there's congestion for no apparent reason. And the congestion gets worse and worse over time. Now, congestion means, when I'm out in it, that I am using gasoline for going nowhere fast, because my car is still on. I'm not able to turn it off when I'm only going 15 miles an hour. The U.S. Department of Transportation estimates that Americans wasted 3 billion gallons of gasoline in 1984 due to congestion, and they project that we will waste 7 billion gallons by the year 2000. So there I am, going nowhere fast in my car. But as I drive, I am polluting the air. As Alan Durning says in How Much Is Enough, the book that I have here, which is in the bookstore, I'll pass it around for people to take a look at. He says, the simple act of starting a car imperceptibly changes the global climate. This is something that we normally don't think of when we turn on the car. For each gallon of gas I use, I put 20 pounds of pollution into the air. Gasoline is about 85% carbon, and as the gas burns in my engine, the carbon is released into the air, where it combines with oxygen to become carbon dioxide, which weighs 4 times as much as the original carbon. If I get 20 miles per gallon in my car, I only get 1 mile per pound of pollution. Again, this is not the way that we ever say things in our culture, because pollution is what we would call a side effect of cars. It's not an effect at all. But in fact, in that thinking that I was talking about the other day, pollution is as much of an effect of cars as transportation is. My car and others like it are responsible for about 1/3 of fossil fuel carbon dioxide emissions in the United States. On a single trip to work, therefore, I contribute 40 pounds of pollution to the greenhouse effect. It will take 200 trees to absorb the carbon dioxide emitted by the average American car this year. This means that my work, when I get there, had better have some lasting benefit. Otherwise, we are buying education at the cost of the biosphere. But my car is not through polluting yet. Carbon dioxide is only one of the emissions that it has. It also pollutes the air with nitrogen oxide, carbon monoxide, lead, sulfur dioxide, and particulate matter. The lead especially may concentrate in the soils where it finally settles, and it can have serious health consequences for children. Cars pollute the air, but they also pollute our ears. People in cars often find highway noise so irritating that they close the windows and turn on the air conditioning, thus affecting the ozone layer, because the air conditioners, at least in current cars, although Ford now has one that doesn't use chlorofluorocarbons, but the Freon in automobile air conditioners has to do with the ozone hole over Antarctica. People who live in homes near highways experience so much noise that they too keep their windows closed, losing the benefits of ventilation. Finally, cars pollute the landscape as hulks, as wrecks. My first car, a 1964 Rambler with electric clutch. Electric clutch. Does anybody remember that? Yeah. This was an amazing car, though. I happened to be going to school at Loyola in Chicago, which is on the lake, and I had a student teaching about 15 miles away in a direction in which it was impossible to get public transit there early enough for me to get there. So I had to buy a car at the age of 20 in Chicago, single male in an urban area, buying a car. The car itself cost only about $400, partly because it had the electric clutch. The electric clutch meant that you had to shift the car, but there was no clutch actually to do it. You just had to sort of know when to shift, and then you shifted it. And the guy at Honest Ben Franklin, auto dealer, assured me that it was just a sort of simple spring mechanism, no big deal. So I bought this car, and then I had to pay twice as much per year in insurance for it, because I was a single male in an urban area. Driving. But fortunately, the car only lasted 6 months, and then it died. And I took it into a, six months, and I took it into a Rambler dealer in Champaign-Urbana, where I had moved by that time, and said, this is a Rambler with an electric clutch. You know, the guy I bought it from said, it's really no big deal to fix the clutch. It was the clutch that had screwed up. And he said, my God, I've never seen that. Ooh, this is not good news. This is not good news at all. So he told me that he thought maybe he would be able to figure out how it worked, and possibly he could fix it, but he could give me no estimate at all of what it might cost to do that. He could replace the clutch for $400, which was the cost of the car. Or he could actually put in a real clutch, which was for $400, which was the cost of the car. But the car never started anyway. I was a member of the Amoco Motor Club until they dropped me that year with that car. So it went to the A1 auto graveyard. But when I think about it, I don't know where my other cars are. The two that I just traded in are now part of the problem of invisible complexity. They're out of my sight and out of my mind. And this article that Joel cued me into today has to do, it's a John McPhee article. So it's a really elegantly written article on used automobile tires, which I think is a wonderful topic. And he's found this tire dump in Southern California, and he's tried to figure out how many tires are in it. And he gets aerial maps of the area, because it covers acres and acres and acres. And then he knows about how high it is. And so then he gets out his calculator and figures it out. So here he is. Well, I had been given estimates of 8, 9, 15, 25, 42, and 44. The calculator was reporting that in the world's largest known pile, there are 34 million tires. You don't have to stare long at that pile before the thought occurs to you that these tires were once driven upon by friends of the earth. They're not just the used tires of bureaucrats, ballplayers, and litter-strewing, rock-deafened ninja teenage nerds. They are everybody's tires. They are Environmental Defense Fund tires, Rainforest Action Network tires, Wilderness Society tires, the California Natural Resources Federation tires, Save San Francisco Bay Association tires, Citizens for a Better Environment tires. They are Greenpeace tires, Sierra Club tires, Earth Island Institute tires. They are Earth First tires. No one is innocent of scrapping these tires. They who carry out what they carry in have not carried out these tires. Of the problem the tire pile represents, everybody is the cause, and the problem, like the pile, has been increasing. The California Integrated Waste Management Board has referred to, quote, the state's growing tire population. And he goes on to say in the articles that tires, you know, they're built to, you know, take us through really rough road conditions, and they're built so well that they're virtually indestructible. Although they contain a tremendous amount of oil, millions of gallons of oils in these tires, if there was a way to extract it. And the rest of the article is about people who are in fact trying to do something with tires by shredding them and turning them into roads, or by burning them, all kinds of things that you can do with tires. And it does leave you with some, as I say, minimal hope at the end.
Primitive sandals.
Yeah.
Cement manufacturing. That's the most promising.
Yeah. Playgrounds and soccer fields. Crushing them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they shred them and
34
make them
tires.
But that's
one. That's just one dump. I think we dump. There's one of the other magazines.
There's that water place where they dump them in that lake too.
Right.
Millions of tires.
There's a pit that we saw.
Connecticut.
McPhee describes in here. It was a brickmaker had this pit, so they had excavated stuff from it, and it, you know, filled up with water, and now this guy, he just dumps all the tires in this pit, and they're sinking in there, and they don't, for some reason, they don't make the water overflow in this pit, but it's really an amazing thing. And again, he goes through all these.
One of the things he put out, it doesn't breed mosquitoes in because the tires are underwater.
Yeah, it doesn't breed mosquitoes in this particular dump. All other dumps tend to breed lots of mosquitoes because tires are a wonderful spot for that. And there's some particular species of mosquitoes that he talks about in here that have almost no range at all. They would be confined to a space as large as Holden if it weren't for the fact that they're transported in used auto tires. And now they inhabit almost all of the Western Hemisphere because they've been moved around because of that. And I was also, I'm doing this thing on cars, and I look at the room right out there, and the Garbage magazine has a thing on green cars. And they have some statistics here in the front on cars also. I think that one of them was, I think, that there are 9 billion used tires in the United States a year. Yeah, let's see, here we go. Actually, better yet, I'll pass it around. You guys can look for it. I'll keep talking. Okay, so cars cause all this pollution, but cars also cause immediate health problems for the flesh and bones of biological beings, which are not designed for impacts up to 60 miles an hour. In the United States, cars kill about 40,000 people a year, and they injure many more. The health-related costs of cars are extraordinary. In fact, this article that I was reading on congestion says that there are sort of immediate health effects of being in congestion, the way that blood pressure changes and chests tighten and breathing changes and all kinds of things like that. People who drive to work through congestion regularly are more likely to be dissatisfied with their jobs, more likely to be anxious about their jobs, more likely to switch their jobs. There are all kinds of psychological effects of being involved in the kind of congestion that we have in our metropolitan areas. So there are these sort of immediate health effects if you happen to come into collision with a car, or if you happen to be in a car that's in a collision. On the other hand, there are kind of indirect health effects of cars. When I drive in my car, I'm involved in a physical activity that includes sitting, hand-eye coordination, minor wrist movements, and some coordinated footsteps. When I am driving, I am not involved in any other form of physical activity, and so my muscular development is not enhanced very much. Cars have indirect as well as direct health effects. Given all these social costs of my cars, it might be sensible for me to sell them. but I live in a metropolitan area that has been shaped by cars and which now virtually requires cars. Studies show that roughly 80% of American driving is for, quote, necessities, like commuting and shopping and going to get gas in the car. After World War II, almost all new housing built in metropolitan areas was located in the suburbs. From 1960 to 1980, two-thirds of all jobs created have been located in the suburbs. As a result, the number of commutes within central city areas has remained fairly stable, while the number of trips between central cities and suburbs and from suburb to suburb has doubled in the same time. As Michael Renner suggests, the automobile has actually created more distance than it overcomes. My cars are problematic by themselves, but they run on 3 million miles of paved roads in the United States. Roads which are not anymore fields or forests or farmlands, and which have the sort of effects that Mike was talking about earlier. The United States has paved 60,000 square miles of its territory, which is about 2% of total surface area and 10% of all arable land. If you were to sort of image this on the map of the United States, you would imagine the state of Georgia completely and entirely paved over. That's the amount that we've paved. In most American cities, almost half of urban space goes to accommodate the automobile. In Los Angeles, it is two-thirds. Okay, now, in the United States, our highway policies have to be considered a form of social, economic, energy, and ecological engineering. Shifting now to sort of the politics of cars and the policy involved with cars. Early on in 1917, the gas tax was passed to provide money for roads. And interestingly enough, James Flink writes about this in his book, people were enthused about the gas tax. This is something that has changed in the interim. But in 1917, people were enthused about the gas tax. They were anxious to pay it so that the roads would be built and things would get better. Somebody should send a note about that to Clinton, let him know that there's a chance that we're enthused again about some form of energy tax. During the 1930s, the government took note of the efficiencies of Germany's Autobahn system, but not of the efficiencies of its Volkswagen at that time, and mapped an interstate system as early as 1939. But World War II intervened, and post-war conversion delayed construction. But car traffic doubled between 1940 and 1954. So in 1956, the federal government passed the Interstate Highway Act, pledging a 90% federal share for the construction of an integrated system of 41,000 miles of freeway, which I presume most of us have used in one way or another in that time. These roads connect a great many places in the country, but they also divide places. Limited access highways, especially the interstates, have killed rural towns and divided urban communities. Because if you don't have the access to the interstate, it's very difficult to sort of carry on need that. In Minneapolis, Interstate 35W runs north into the city and makes a sharp swerve at the crosstown highway. Why is this? It's a swerve that just really seems stupid when you're driving. So you go up, it's an absolute right angle, and then it's a right angle again to go north. And there are two reasons for it, as far as I can tell. One of them has to do with routing. The first plans were for it to go straight up Lindale Avenue. And then it would have led to an area of congestion where Lindale meets Hennepin near downtown. But I think another reason that they made that swerve is that right in front of the highway, when it begins to make that swerve, is an upper middle class neighborhood called Tangletown.
Of course.
And I suspect that those folks had the clout to say, move that highway over. And they did. And they moved it up and ran it right up north through the city, through a racially mixed neighborhood, dividing it making one side of the road primarily white, the other side of the road primarily black. And I've known people who lived there before the interstate who had racially mixed friends and who lost those friends because parents didn't want them walking over the bridges on the
You lived interstate. In Chicago, and it said that not a single Catholic church was taken out by any of the expressways. Lutheran churches were, but not a single Catholic church.
Well, this makes sense in the era of Brother Richard Daley. Yeah. Actually, that sort of in thinking about what gets taken out, this in the In Context magazine, which I passed around, there is an article about a development in on Vancouver Island called Bamberton, where they're trying to do a planned ecologically sustainable development. And one of the things that they've said in this is that in almost all cases, when a road would take out a tree, the road has to go around it. Hmm. And the consequence of that is that the roads in this place are gonna move a lot. And that suggests that the traffic's gonna be slower. And that suggests that it's gonna be a more congenial place for pedestrian activity, which is really what they're trying to do. They're trying to get back to an old-time city center that's a pedestrian area and which has a combination of things, and to get all of the houses in town within, I think, 6 minutes of the city center. It's also true that America's love affair with the automobile has an international impact, with detrimental effects on many third world cultures as they try to imitate American styles of production. And this is one of the things that Durning, in that book on How Much Is Enough, was very good at pointing out, that our consumption not only affects us, but because it's kind of a model for the world, it affects all kinds of other people who aren't able economically to pollute as much as we are, but who would like to. Okay, we can talk a little bit about solutions here. I mean, it's a very, very, very complex problem. Cars are an American life. American automobility is an integral part of the moral ecology of everyday life. Cars are not likely to disappear anytime soon, but it may be that we can improve their environmental impact. Now, some of the solutions will be technical. They will involve lighter cars with alternate fuels, cars powered by natural gas, or by the sun, or by hydrogen. And all of these things are in the works now. So actually, some of them may be even solar-powered cars. There's a race that was going on as I left Minneapolis called the Sun Race, spelled S-U-N-R-A-Y-C-E, with all solar-powered cars going from Texas to Minnesota. It's about a 1,500-mile race. And these cars can go about 30, 40 miles an hour just on the power of the sun. The technology allows them to do that. They're not going to be commercially available for a long time. They have absolutely no crash impact protection at all, because the whole thing is just a skin of solar cells and then a place for an individual to sit in the middle there. But it does suggest that you can use the sun to power cars. And Mercedes-Benz has produced a model of a hydrogen car that would run on hydrogen, but it's very difficult to do that because you have to extract the hydrogen from water, which is a difficult process to do, and then you need these very, very heavy storage tanks for it, because I think it's highly combustible. And right now, the most that they can, the greatest distance they can get on a tank full of hydrogen in this car is 75 miles, which is probably not going to be enough for most Americans who are used to different things like that. Okay, but and there's, I pass around the Garbage magazine that went around. That's got an article in there on green cars, on these kinds of cars, on the ways in which cars will technically be improved. But technical solutions will not be enough. The very success of mass motorization, claims Michael Renn, has created conditions that cannot be ameliorated simply by making cars more efficient and less polluting. Okay, so a second way may be, some solutions may be regulatory, trying to give an honest accounting of the cost of cars. It may be that if we can figure ways to charge ourselves the full cost of a car all the way through, so that I would have to pay at some point or another for the disposal of my car as well, or for all of the kinds of social and ecological effects of my car, that I would drive less because it would be a heck of a lot more expensive than it is now. And some of the things that are being proposed here are simply tolls, to charge tolls on what are now free, quote, free ways, and which give us the illusion that they're free, which they're not. Another is to sort of do like we do with Xerox machines at the college, and they have sort of per mile charges on cars. Another is, it's in use now a lot, is carpool lanes. The new highway coming west out of Minneapolis is designed with carpool lanes and with not enough lanes to handle the rest of the cars. It's designed to be a highway that will be congested unless people change their driving habits, since it's simply the way it was planned. Another possibility is that we may decide to subsidize other forms of transportation as much as we have subsidized cars in the last century. We think of cars as being part of private enterprise, but there's been a tremendous public subsidy for cars in this country. Not so much that the money is given to car companies to have them produce cars, but in terms of the building of roads and infrastructure and the amount of government money that goes to things like traffic lights and things like that.
I've kind of been through all the transportation industries in their heyday.
That's true, and if you sort of look at the map of the railroad land grants that were given in the 19th century, I think 1/5 of the state of Minnesota was in these railroad land grants. And it may be that we decide that bicycles or something else will be a better transportation solution for us, and that we want to subsidize that in the same way that we've done other transportation technologies. Or it might be that light rail is one of the things that we want to think about. Another possibility for solutions is simply shifting geography. We use cars to get to places we want to go. And if we could move to places we want to go so that they were accessible to us without cars, we wouldn't need them as much. So it's a matter of rearranging the spaces of our lives. And again, we're not talking about a project that will be over in 5 years. So to say, well, let's take the city of Minneapolis and rearrange it so that we can use cars left, and we'll rearrange it in 5 years. We're talking about projects that are 100 years in length. And again, as a historian, I feel comfortable with changes that take place over 100 years. But other people are a little more anxious about it than that, and they do want five-year solutions. And I simply, as a historian, don't see five-year solutions. Cultural changes come very, very slow.
You want to put the mega mall out of business, apparently.
I'd be willing to do that, yeah, I would.
And well, that strikes out, I think, some fundamental values regarding property. Because the expansion of cities or whatever and the building of malls is really rooted in private property and the right to build your home wherever you want to and build a mall just wherever people want to build it.
Right. Although it's true that even now the developers have to get permits from cities and the cities are zoned in particular ways. And in fact, this causes problems in cities. I'm in a suburb where we don't have very much low-cost housing at all. It tends to be an upper-middle-class suburb. And the state of Minnesota has, I think, passed a law saying that every community has to have low-cost housing. People in Eden Prairie are not very pleased about this.
But a lot of suburbanization was to escape the city, escape that regulation.
And a lot of urban problems are connected to the automobile, because the automobile allowed people a way to get away from the problems that they didn't want to see. So that, part of the invisible complexity of cars is the invisible poor, if you want to put it that way. When I'm in my car driving, on all the places that I normally drive, being a suburbanite, I don't see very many poor people. So they're outside of mind. And this is the way that we've structured our society over the last 50 years. It used to be that there was, in cities, a lot more contact between people of different classes. But we are now a class-segregated society, and the car has allowed us to do that. And government policy has allowed us to do that, too. In the 1950s, for example, it was FHA loans were much easier to get in the suburbs than they were to get in the cities. And in fact, the FHA redlined some city areas because they didn't think they could get the return on the mortgages. So the government was essentially encouraging people to buy houses in the suburbs in the 1950s. Now, if you want to think about sort of changing the geography of things, a book that I would recommend that you look at is a book by Dolores Hayden called Redesigning the American Dream. And the dream that she's talking about is not cars, which is what I'm talking about today. The dream that she's talking about is a single family home, which is related, I think, to cars. And it's a really wonderful book on the history of ways to try to collectivize or to bring more people together in housing. And one of the solutions that she had, which I really liked, I lived in Minneapolis on just sort of a normal city block. One of the solutions that she had was simply to turn the block around, to turn the houses around. Right now, all of them are oriented to the street. And so everybody looks out to the street. And there's an alley that runs down the back, which picks up, the garbage trucks run in there, and there are some garages back there and stuff like that. But her suggestion was, clear out the area in the middle there, clear out the garages and all that stuff, and make that into green space, and put a community center in there and a garden and some benches and some things like that, and allow people to use that area for a kind of sociability that they lose in an area of cars. And then just put all of the sort of facility stuff on the street, sort of orient everything in rather than out, and to try to structure geographically a kind of community. And she has lots and lots of suggestions like that. Another thing would be to change zoning so that right now most houses are zoned only for single family, and you can't have mother-in-law parking and things like that. So you don't have much of an age mix in many American areas either. It's like working with kids around. You don't have much of an age mix either, and you could get a kind of age mix by changing zoning regulations in different cities. So this is another kind of possibility, and that article on Bamberton that's going around gives some sense of the way that you could do a planned community, and not having to do a whole lot of planning to do that either. Other solutions may, though, as David Orr points out in his book, Ecological Literacy, involve changes in character and purpose. He would say that the people who say that technology can be, you know, we just sort of change everything technically with cars and we'll be all right. He calls these people, I think, Disneyland postmodernists. sort of sense that there's...